Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Tuesday, September 29th. Justice and the Justice Department. We already had a very relevant guest lined up for this, Andrew Weissman, one of the lead prosecutors in the Mueller investigation and a former head of the Justice Department's Criminal Fraud Division. He has a book out today called Where Law Ends. And then the news broke on Sunday night about the New York Times obtaining and analyzing a number of President Trump's tax returns or data from tax returns. Obviously, you've been hearing coverage of that here and elsewhere. And it turns out the tax returns could be relevant to one of the revelations in Andrew Weissman's book, that the Mueller team decided not to closely scrutinize Trump's finances for reasons we'll get into. And one of the big questions the Times story raises, to whom does President Trump owe hundreds of millions of dollars coming due soon? And could it be people in foreign countries who would then have leverage over U.S. policy? Andrew Weissman reminds us of this line spoken by Eric Trump in 2014. Eric Trump, in the context of the Trump Organization buying all these golf courses at that time, said, well, we don't rely on American banks. We have all the funding we need out of Russia. Andrew Weissman tweeted out that clip to remind us of it over the weekend, that quote. Very interesting. So let's see if we can connect the dots. They may connect or not, but the issue raised by the tax returns, the Mueller team's limitations as revealed in the book, and the state of justice at the United States Justice Department all converge for the conversation we're about to have with Andrew Weissman, these days a criminal and national security law professor at NYU and a partner in the law firm of Jenner and Block. He was general counsel for the FBI when Robert Mueller was director. Mueller was director for 12 years, people forget. Weissman directed the Enron Task Force, if you remember that financial fraud scandal. Going back even further, he prosecuted police officers in connection with the attack on Abner Louima here in New York in the 90s. He was a lead prosecutor in the Mueller investigation, and his new book out today is called Where Law Ends Inside the Mueller Investigation. Mr. Weissman, thanks for making this one of your stops on the first morning the book is out. Welcome to WNYC.
Great to be here, Brian.
So in your book, you argue that the Mueller investigation failed to do everything it could to determine the extent of Donald Trump's relationship with Russia during the 2016 campaign. And one of those failures was in not looking closely at Trump's finances. Could you start there and take a few minutes if you need to and describe what you wanted to look at regarding financial ties and why you couldn't?
Sure. I think the best place to start is to compare the limitations we were under when you compare that to some of the other cases you mentioned, pursuing Enron, or I also pursued organized crime figures in New York City. Mm-hmm. In Enron and in organized crime cases, the people that you're investigating do not have the power to pull the plug on your investigation. You are free to investigate them and to make decisions without worrying about whether you're going to have a job the next day. In the special counsel's office, because we were investigating the president for 22 months, there was no time that we were confident that we were going to be there the following day. And one of the ways that that played out was early on in the investigation, we issued a subpoena to Deutsche Bank, and the White House got wind of that. And I describe in the book what happened. They were irate, and they wanted to know, were we investigating the president's finances? Obviously, that's a huge red flag for any investigator. You know, if you have nothing to hide, why are you so upset about that? Mm-hmm. And it turns out we were that subpoena was actually issued out of, you know, the team I led, which was Paul Manafort's team, and we were pursuing an investigation regarding his finances. And Special Counsel Mueller made the decision, which is a difficult one at that point, which was, do you go forward with a financial investigation at risk of the whole investigation, you know, ending right there because the president says you're done, you're finished? Or do you say, you know what, we don't need to do this right now, let's go forward? And Director Mueller made the, you know, that decision. That led, of course, to all sorts of benefits, which is we investigated and charged various Russians and Russian companies for hacking into the DNC, for interfering in the Russian election. And out of my team, we learned with the cooperation of Rick Gates that Paul Manafort had been sharing internal Trump campaign polling data with a Russian intelligence operative. So there were lots of benefits, but my issue is that although that you can defend the decision early on not to cross the line into a financial investigation, I think it became harder and harder to not revisit that. And that's where I have an issue with what we did. I think that that decision needed to be revisited. And as I describe in my book, my view and other people's views were, you know what, the worst thing that happens is we get fired, but at least we're doing our job, which was to pursue all reasonable avenues that we were tasked with pursuing. So we never looked at the president's finances and followed the money in a way that we did actually with respect to Paul Manafort.
Interesting. So the Mueller team ultimately pulled its punches out of fear of getting fired altogether by the president, and that's a central tenet of the book, and you give a number of examples of that. And you cited Deutsche Bank, and I wonder if you can go to the content of that and tell us what your best understanding is from the evidence you have about any relationship between Trump and Russia through Deutsche Bank, because I've seen it described as perhaps a conduit for money from Trump, from Russia, I'm sorry, to Trump without Russia's fingerprints being on it. But what can you actually tell us from what you were able to learn?
So the bottom line, Brian, is not a lot because we did not do that investigation. So things that you would be interested in knowing are both money that would go to candidate Trump or in the past, or even Russian money or any foreign money that would go into the campaign, but using front companies. We were able to see some of that during the inauguration, where we showed that Ukraine oligarchs had actually used a front person to pay money into the inaugural campaign, I mean, the inaugural fund. So we don't know the answer. And that is one of the reasons that I take us to task. And I was trying to be as clear-eyed as I could about what I thought we did right and the challenges we faced, but also trying to, you know, be level with the American public as to what we didn't do and try and set out some facts and some guidance for how I think this should be done in the future.
You also mentioned specifically in the book that the same business account that sent money from Trump to Michael Cohen to pay Stormy Daniels hush money regarding the alleged affair, that same bank account had received payments linked to a Russian oligarch. Is this a place where you can connect any dots to questions raised by the tax returns?
Well, there definitely are places, including the one that you mentioned, where Michael Cohen has got money going into the same account that was then used to pay off Stormy Daniels. You also see it in the New York Times reporting in something that struck me as an oddity, which was an oligarch, a Russian oligarch named Agalarov, is the person who fronted the money for the 2013 Miss Universe pageant, which happened in Moscow. And as the Times reports, although the
run by Trump, he fronted Trump the money to that for that, right? Trump ran that thing. Yeah,
exactly. And so Trump ran the Miss Universe pageant. The Aguilars are fronting the money. And according to New York Times reporting, there are a couple of oddities. One, that Miss Universe pageant seemed to be unusually profitable. But the Aguilaras apparently did not make any money, even though they were the ones who were putting up the money. But you have Trump making a couple million dollars off of the Miss Universe pageant. So, you know, one of the questions you have is, like, how did that happen? And is this a way that money was being funneled from the Aguilars to Donald Trump? And it's worth noting that the Aguilars are the same people who orchestrated the Trump Tower meeting in June of 2016. It was their emissaries who came to the Trump Tower meeting saying that they have dirt on Hillary Clinton. And famously, Don Jr. responded, "If you have dirt on Hillary Clinton, you know, we love it." So that's also a connection that is worth exploring.
And let's take a phone call from John in Manhattan. John, you're on WNYC with Andrew Weissman.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could address Trump acting or not acting in large areas in order to manipulate interest rates and therefore benefit the payment of his own debt over the national interest.
Interesting. John, thank you very much. We know Trump always is lobbying the Fed for lower interest rates. Usually it's assumed to be to maximize economic growth on his watch, so he looks like he's successful at running the economy. I guess John's asking whether it can be for his own personal gain as well.
So, John, that is a really good question. One of the, you know, key obvious questions that you have when you learn that somebody has $420 million in debt, or alleges that he does, is, one, the people who have that debt, what is it that they want? What kind of leverage do they have on the President of the United States? But the second question is the one you hit, which is the President going to take positions that benefits him personally, even though it may not be in the public interest? And one of the ways that one tries to assure that that doesn't happen is by transparency. That's the reason that presidents for decades have revealed their tax returns, so that the American public has the ability to make an assessment about what are the interests at stake and whether the president is doing something as he is required to do in the public interest, not in his personal interest. And to tie it to the special counsel investigation, one of the reasons that I'm critical of the decision not to eventually revisit the issue with respect to the financial investigation is precisely the one that you hit on. If you're trying to figure out if there is a foreign government that has influence over the president, you really need to follow the money. It's, you know, this is not rocket science. It's, you know, everyone who's, you know, watched the movie All the President's Men or has studied Watergate knows that's a classic way in which you do an investigation. And here, while it is true that that could have resulted in us being fired, at some point you need to just say, well, we have to do our job, and if we get fired, we get fired.
So let's go even deeper on justice and the U.S. Justice Department, which is supposed to be above politics and for the rule of law, as you've been indicating, so central to calling ourselves a democracy at all. It looks to so many people now, like Attorney General Barr, is devolving it to the kind of legal arm of the Trump legal team and Trump's attempt to be a leader above the law, like in an authoritarian country. But to listen to Barr, he seems to genuinely believe the politicization of the department is from the Democrats or from blind spots in the department itself for going so hard after Trump and his people criminally because they despise what he stands for, Barr would assert. And you know, the two sides to this story. I guess my question is, are there two sides to this story, in your opinion, regarding factions in the Justice Department who each feel aggrieved and each believe they are upholding the rule of law?
So it won't surprise you, Brian, that I do not think there are two sides to this story, and I don't think you can have an equivalence. And not to make this complete analogy, but I think the same could be said in Charlottesville. We were tasked by the acting attorney general to investigate, and were given specific things that we were supposed to look at, and that's what we did. And again, you can just follow the facts. It doesn't matter whether we are Republicans or Democrats. The facts proved that Paul Manafort was guilty. Rick Gates was guilty. There were a slew of convictions based on what we did, either where the person admitted it out of their own mouth or where the jury, beyond a reasonable doubt, concluded that we were right. So that goes without question, given those findings. Mm-hmm. But for Attorney General Barr then to take up the language of rule of law in when he says that he was right to lower the sentence of Roger Stone or to seek to dismiss the Michael Flynn case, that is just simply not true. He has taken positions that are favorable to people who are affiliated with the President of the United States, but those same standards, this is what's fundamental to the rule of law. You're supposed to be applying those same standards across the board. It shouldn't matter that it's Roger Stone or Michael Flynn. But in fact, as judges have pointed out, and there's a hearing today on Michael Flynn, those are positions that the Department of Justice has not applied to people who are not friends of the President of the United States. And to your point, this really is what this concept of really needing to follow the rule of law and not giving favorable treatment to friends of the president or unfavorable treatment to enemies is what separates us from autocracies. What separates us from Ukraine, for instance, where the President Yanukovych had imprisoned his political opponent. Mm-hmm. And as my college classmate Marie Yovanovitch pointed out, we're now taking positions in the United States that are antithetical to the values that we've been trying to inculcate in other parts of the world.
We have just a few minutes left with Andrew Weissman, former lead prosecutor in the Mueller investigation, whose new book is called Where Law Ends, Inside the Mueller Investigation. And let me take one more phone call for you that goes back to the question of what you learned as an investigator with Mueller and how it might relate to Trump's tax returns as revealed by the New York Times this weekend. And it's Lori in Queens. You're on WNYC. Hi, Lori.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question is that since Trump is being investigated by the Attorney General for fraud in the use of getting loans, saying that he had assets that he doesn't have, having this show on these tax returns that he's on one hand taking huge losses while at the same time saying he has money when he's applying for bank loans, isn't this part of that case that New York State is trying to bring?
Terrific question, Lori. So this is, to me, what is going on in the New York State Attorney General's office and the Manhattan DA's office. So that's both a civil case in the connection with the Attorney General's office and a criminal case in connection with the Manhattan District Attorney's office. Seems to me to be a classic case involving tax fraud and money laundering. And one of the things that you look at, as we did when we were investigating Paul Manafort, is seeing whether someone carried through with their financial incentives, let's put it that way, which is when you don't want to pay a lot of taxes, you inflate your losses and deflate your income so that you can end up paying bizarrely, $750 in taxes, which one thing that's striking to me is it just so happens in 2 years, it just landed on that exact number, which seems like a red flag. At the same time, when you're trying to get loans from a bank and from people to invest, you have the opposite incentive where you want to say you have lots of income and you have very little debt. So one of the things I suspect is going on at the state level is that they have the state tax returns that were submitted by Donald Trump and his organization. And one of the reasons they're fighting so hard to get the accounting documents is they want to compare what it is that the accountants knew and were being told by Donald Trump and the Trump organization to what they told the New York State tax authorities and what they told banks in trying to get loans. So it seems like a classic investigation. And I think you're seeing both sets of law enforcement agencies acting appropriately aggressively to get the information.
I want to ask you a follow-up question about that, but I have to do my legal ID first. This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We are New York and New Jersey Public Radio. And now the interview with Andrew Weissman won't be the last one I ever do because the FCC says you didn't do the legal ID close enough to the top of the hour. Do you think that the New York Times revelations could actually become evidence in the New York prosecutors' cases? It seems like the New York Times knew more as of 2 days ago than the New York State Attorney General or the Manhattan DA.
I'm confident that both sets of state lawyers have pored over the New York Times reporting, looking for leads. Having said that, one of the things that the New York Times reporting does not give them is the actual underlying data. And as prosecutors, that's the thing that you need. So while you have leads coming from the New York Times reporting, you don't have all of the information. But of course, one of the things that the state has is they have subpoena power, which is something that the New York Times, as good as their reporting is and remarkable, does not have. So you could expect that you will see additional efforts on their part to get information.
So last question, do you conclude in the book or do you come any closer to concluding on the basis of this New York Times tax return reporting that any foreign country has leverage over Donald Trump?
So the answer to that is we don't know. We don't know the answer to that. And the way I look at that issue is very much the way I look at the question that many of us asked when we were finding deplorable what James Comey did in October of 2016 by injecting into the election the issue of the Clinton emails. And everyone there, as I know, was asking sort of, did that affect the election or did it not affect the election? And my take was always, we're all entitled not to have to ask that question. We shouldn't be in the position where Americans have to wonder whether that did or did not have an effect. And that's sort of my take on your question, Brian, which is, I think that we should have looked at the financial records. I understand the initial decision not to, but I don't agree with the decision to continue with that position throughout the investigation. And so we're in a position where we don't currently have the answer to your question. And I feel like Americans are entitled to know that answer.
Andrew Weissman was a lead investigator on the Mueller team. His new book, out today, is called Where Law Ends, Inside the Mueller Investigation. Thank you so much for giving us so much time and for answering these questions so deeply. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.